So I wanted to, you know, get more involved with the writing community in New York outside of just comedy.
It's like a really perfect screenplay. It's like
movies have budget. Let a real comedy writer have a pass at the comedy.
Action coming of age genre bend, sometimes from the 80s, sometimes referred to as the go for it genre.
The thing that we want to talk about is the craft.
Took out all the stakes for me, and nobody really dies at a low point. In a thriller, somebody's supposed to.
It was a lot more earned than it was in this.
The Soderbergh question. Process. What's more interesting? Thriller stakes or the actual process of things
I
being
I wish there were more films like this in the theater.
Welcome to the third episode of The Script, the official podcast of the NYC Screenwriters Collective, a not-for-profit screenwriting workshop dedicated to teaching the craft of writing for film and television here in New York City. The Script podcast is the best parts of our workshop, our best script doctors, the hottest screenplays, and our best discussions on the screenwriting craft and current events in film and television.
166, back online.
60 years ago, Earth was attacked. We won the war, but they destroyed half the planet. Everyone's been evacuated. Nothing human remains.
Today, for episode 3, we're going to bring you a screenplay review of Oblivion by William Monahan, an earlier draft than the film you might see in the movies. It's available on our website. We're also going to have a new edition of The Tracking Board review by Tracking Board czar Mike DeLuca. And then we're going to have The Baron's Corner.
Interior, stadium, tunnel. Jack stands at the tunnel entrance, shining a light into the depths. The sound is clear now, a low whimpering. Jack makes his way down the tunnel carefully. Ahead, the tunnel meets the circular tunnel that rings the stadium. His light plays over the silty floor, finds a dog, starving, shivering. It cowers in the corner. Hey there, boy, easy. Jack moves forward, hand out. You got nothing to be scared of, buddy. The dog suddenly scurries away into the dark. Behind Jack, a huge form rises. We see gray skin, teeth, and Jack hears its heavy, labored breath. Ah, shit. Jack sprints full speed. The animal, a giant, emaciated, hairless bear, comes surging out of the darkness, lumbering after him. Jack tears back down the tunnel, the bear's form almost filling the tunnel behind him. He puts on a burst of speed, but stumbles, sliding on his chest, arm outstretched towards the drone door as the bear leaps. He reaches, flips the drone's fuel cell door shut. Drone 166 reactivates. It surges up, weapons powering up, and rip! It opens up with white plasma fire on the bear, which seems to go Nova in midair, disintegrating to black ash, which covers Jack. Jack stumbles to his feet. Drone 166 now wheels on him. Its smoking red-hot cannons inches from his face. Jack averts his gaze as the drone scans Jack, breathing hard, hating this moment. With its ganglia still hanging out, it doesn't seem to be processing. And then, just as quickly, the drone rockets up into the sky and is gone. Jack falls to his knees in the sand, exhausted.
That was from Oblivion, a script by William Monahan, the March 27, 2011 draft. We're reviewing Oblivion today on the Script podcast. Welcome. Your script doctors are Christopher Theokis, David Negrin, and Chris Durham. Today, yeah, we're doing Oblivion, the Tom Cruise vehicle. It's directed by Joseph Kosinski of Tron Legacy fame. Script, as I said, William Monahan, Kings of Heaven, The Departed, Body of Lies. Very excited for action-adventure sci-fi genre to be back. It's a cyclical genre, you know. It comes and goes every couple of years, but I think thanks to Avatar, we're getting a whole slew of sci-fis coming back. A couple things coming out very soon. We got Passengers by John Spates is now in production. Pacific Rim, written by Travis Beecham's coming out under Del Toro. It's going to be a sci-fi extravaganza next couple of years. Four Quadrant sci-fi extravaganza, by
all
the way.
All four quadrants.
All four quadrants. Yes. We're not talking about the Solaris remake here.
no fifth quadrant, octogenarian.
No, you know, no Delta quadrant stuff.
Well, no, they're in the fourth quad. They're in like the fourth quadrant, 25 and above. So
I'm just at a point that I don't know how to feel about a flick that isn't based on a comic book or a sequel.
Well,
or
actually, Oblivion was a graphic novel
yeah.
which is interesting. I want to see if the visuals match up. I want to check out some of it because, you know, the Tet and the sky hotel room. What was that?
the sky hotel room.
Sky suite, as we might call it. And you know, the bubble ship itself. I want to see if it matches up.
Yeah. These guys apparently talked to JPL.
NASA JPL.
Yeah, to determine how, you know, the moon being blown up would affect the Earth, and, you know, if you were going to attack the Earth, what's the best way to do it? It's a cool premise.
Yeah, it is a cool premise. All right, so back to four quadrant scripts, okay? Four quadrants means that you get all four major demographics, right? You want your script to appeal to male, female, over 25, and under 25. That's how you get a script with the potential for a Hollywood tentpole. How do you get it? Couple of things. You need a role for a star, right? We got that here. Jack is our working class, strong, brave, and expert at his job. He's funny. He breaks the rules, you know, so that he can bravely explore. This is your basic definition of a modern antihero, okay? You have a perfect template here for Tom Cruise to step in and give it his level best or whatever we expect from Tom these days. Also, Jack is kind of an environmentalist. He's like an environmentalist light, so that goes a little bit with the theme. You need the highest stakes in a four quadrant movie, okay? End of the world, save the world, okay? By the third act, it's gotta be end of the world, save the world. You need big action set pieces. We got plenty of action, great action set pieces here. We got the alien, the technological bad guys, we got the bubble ship, we got plenty of action set pieces. You need plot setups, payoffs, and reveals. Okay, we've got setups and payoffs, a couple of reveals, a big third act reversal, which we're gonna talk about. And you need your love story, okay? For the four quadrants, you gotta give the women's demographic something to stand with all the spaceships and guns. Here we have, in Oblivion, we have not one but two possible love interests, almost a James Bond scenario. Good girl and a secret bad girl, right?
Yeah, but you don't have James Bond in this case. It's like a nice guy having to make a choice.
I wish he was a little cooler, but he goes for working class here. We go with the working class guy instead of the cool hero.
He's the futuristic fix-it guy.
Yeah, there you go.
He's a repairman.
And he works on drones. Right. Yeah. There's no political implication talking about having
heavily armed drones going around killing people.
Okay, no. And you need, okay, last thing for four quadrant movies, you need laughs. And you can tell, I'm not sure if it was William Monahan or somebody else came in and did the pass on to put some jokes up in there, but
they
got it done.
We have the March 27, 2011 draft, and it says current revisions by Carl, whose last name I don't want to butcher, Gajdusek.
Okay, well, maybe Carl did the jokes, because there's some good funny in here. You want to go first, or I'll go first? Well, I'm talking, I'm going to go first. Strengths of the script. Okay, William Monahan, great screenwriter, okay? He did The Departed. He knows how to put in very concise screenwriting on the page, great descriptions and action. He breaks up all this great sort of epic action, mostly two lines, never more than four lines. The entire set piece is never more than half a page. This is how you write action while showcasing the meat of a futuristic sci-fi epic with all these great set pieces. You keep this script moving, right? You don't want to read three pages of description of, you know, of techno babble. You got to keep us moving. Essential action only. Let's see.
Well, I wonder, because it's like this is based on a graphic novel, if, you know, you needed to fill in a lot of the blanks, you know, if the blanks were already filled in terms of visuals. I'm not saying, because I agree with you about the action, but it's like he didn't really have to describe the Tet. He didn't have to, you know, because somebody already drew it.
But see, that's, okay, so visually, yes. And so maybe that gave him a hand. Yeah, but still, what he does is he gets it done.
Yeah,
he explains enough about the Tet that we get the feeling of it. Some of his descriptions that tell the more story than the audience can really see, which makes it a really interesting screenplay. The gatherer is sucking up salt water, harvesting these elements essential to create deuterium, heavy hydrogen. At the top of the giant machine, drones work tirelessly, ferrying containers of deuterium energy up into the sky. I don't know what deuterium is, but it sounds like it's important.
They actually describe what deuterium is in the script.
That's great. Heavy
hydrogen.
Yeah, which is good. Good sci-fi. You want this meat. This is the good stuff of the genre, right? Later on, their idea of how do you do was to blow up our moon. Right? That's great screenwriting,
right? Yeah.
Perfect. One line, and it gets it. It's not going to be on screen. It wasn't even in the voiceover. It was description. But you know, if I wrote the movie, I might have our voiceover person say it.
Yeah, I was going to say that's a good line for somebody to say. It's like he could have said it. I guess we're spoiling the entire thing.
Oh yeah. FYI, we're spoiling this movie.
He could have said it to what's her face? Who just was it?
Victoria?
Julia? No, Julia. When he's telling her like, this is what happened. This is why the world is the way it is. That would have been a great line for that. Yeah. So I'm a little disappointed that wasn't in there. But
interior, sky tower, storage area. Rows and rows of shelves, mainly empty now. Jack and Victoria have gone through almost all of what they needed for a 5-year tour. Jack grabs a container of water.
Yeah.
He just tells so much story in a couple sentences. This is why William Monahan's a great writer. Succinct action. A high-tech, high-powered rifle rests in two alien armored hands like a metal-coated insect tarsus. The barbed feet of a fly. The alien begins to depress the trigger, then another tarsus presses the barrel down. Don't fire. I now know what a tarsus is, and that was like a really cool action scene. This is great writing. He also uses some great tricks. He uses the POV of the alien three times. First of all, we see something is watching him, right? Then we have a gun aimed at him and held. It's not shot. Then the alien on the base of the station. We're like, oh, wow, there might be aliens here. Really sets up for the real reveal later, which that there isn't aliens. Then my favorite screenwriting thing William Monahan did in this whole script, or maybe it was the other guy, was he did this, like, triple play scene. The pool scene early on where Victoria and Jack are swimming together, and they're doing exposition about, you know, what their job is and the things and how... and what they think about the world and the story that's about to come. And then we get our love scene also. They're making out. And then it's this hallucination. It's not Victoria. It's the other girl, right? It's
Julia.
Julia from her voice. And then he wakes up. So in one scene, we get exposition. We establish a Victoria love story. And then we establish the mystery. That's brilliant writing to me. Great setups and payoffs. Earlier on, you know... we find out the drones won't shoot back, right? That's one of the rules of the drones. And so Jack uses it to protect the woman from the drones. Eventually, he steps in front of it because he knows the drones won't shoot him. So
that's
that was
our midpoint, pretty much, right?
I think so. You know, that's when they find out.
When he goes to the shuttle and they find the people on the shuttle, and that's when things go sideways.
That's right. Well, yeah. We find out that the drones are attacking humans. We're like, why would that happen?
Right, okay. And it's typically, the reason I call it out as the midpoint is, like, we talk about in the collective that the midpoint typically, it heralds the beginning of what we could say is a new movie.
Yeah, almost a whole new section.
And it seems even then, in this case, that it felt tonally different to me. Like reading it, like it would have a different visual feel to it once it's put up on the big screen, and so I really liked that was that shift there.
Yeah, a really good demarcation.
Yeah, it was that was excellent.
Trouble with the script. All right, man, here we go.
Well, first off, Mr. Monahan, we love you.
Yes,
we would love to work with you anytime.
No, I already told you he's a great writer, but David
is a heathen.
He was also he clearly had to be. He was getting notes from a studio on a blockbuster tentpole, and you got to do what you got to do. I've done notes. I've taken it before. Okay. But just in general, Blake Snyder likes to talk about double mumbo jumbo in a screenplay, right?
This is aliens and clones.
This script had at least triple, possibly quadruple mumbo jumbo. We've got a post-apocalypse, right? We've got an Earth disaster movie, right? We've got aliens, right? And we've got clones. So this is like, you know, all we need to add is ghosts and we're over the top, right? Or vampires. Can we have vampires? Maybe there's a vampire. Lestat's in the movie, right?
Yeah, that's true. And they, and they make mention that eventually they're going to need different sources of protein.
All right.
So, yeah. There might be vampires in the sequel.
Problem is here, this science fiction movie, so much of this setting and what happened, the setup here is derivative, okay? Like, we've seen all this stuff before. This movie, the first time around, was called WALL-E. Did you see WALL-E?
Yes.
Okay. So, we had to leave the Earth, right? There's one guy left, and he's cleaning up, right? This is like the live-action version of WALL-E, right? And then upstairs on the big, you know, there's a big, you know, cruise ship flying around up there. There's some, you know, all the people, all the humans are living up there. And poor WALL-E, he's got to figure things out on his own down there. He finds some girl, some lost love that he's got to figure it out. I mean, this is like a live-action version of WALL-E. And the only thing that was really original to me in this sci-fi setting was the Tet itself. I thought the thing was cool, and we never go in.
You know, Elysium has kind of its Tet that's going to happen.
Oh, okay. I didn't read Elysium yet.
And there's a gravity.
Well, Elysium, the whole story is about
getting to the Tet. Well, their version
and
of the
and
Tet.
And keeping people off the Tet. This one, yeah, that's the other problem, you know. We never get in the Tet. We never get to really get inside and see, are there humans in there at all? Is anyone there? Is there an elite class there who've perpetuated this lie? Are they having, like, orgies and parties with cucumber sandwiches, right? Like, or are they hunkered down with, like, barely enough food and feeling guilty for perpetuating the lie?
My favorite
and a
part
necessary
of that.
Fraud. You know, are they feeling guilty about it but they're doing what they have to do to keep the human race alive. We don't know. What's the motivation?
Now I do want to go up to the Tet just to see about the cucumber sandwiches.
Yeah, I know.
But and it made me think also, just to get on like the fact that the Tet itself isn't, I mean, it's not a new science fiction trope, because, I mean, even if you go back to, I want to say the mid-90s, if people follow manga, Battle Angel, which is a project that Jim Cameron is incredibly interested in doing, that is another situation where you have a hanging city over the Earth, and it's keeping people out, and, you know, they send things, they send supplies up to this city called Tafaris, and, you know, you can never get up to it.
Right.
The only way you can go up to it is literally in pieces of your organs.
Right. So that's pretty cool. But so what we're saying is this Space Station Earth is now a genre convention of the sci-fi genre. It's more modern convention, but we're starting to see it a lot. So
right.
It's not enough just to have a Tet. You've got to create an interesting one. You've got to show us one we haven't seen before, right? I mean, it's almost Deep Space Nine, right?
And in fact, the ending in the script, in the Oblivion script, is an Independence Day kind of ending, mm-hmm. where they go onto the ship.
Yeah.
You know, in this case, he plants a bomb instead of an apple, you know, based virus. I mean, I know Apple is versatile as a program, but and even in the very end of Independence Day, when Randy Quaid flies up into the alien ship and blows it up, I mean, I don't want to make this sound like these are necessarily bad things. You know, if you look back on science fiction as a genre, it's probably been done. That's not a problem. But what you're saying, I think, holds true. Yeah. It's like, I want to see something new.
Innovate.
I want
it.
To see who's
use
in the
use the
Tet.
Convention, but just reinvent it for us, please.
Right. And it's like, I want to see who is in the Tet.
I mean,
well.
You just touched on it. This is the last thing I have to say, is the ending, the reveal. I mean, it just, they're clones. Really? It sounds to me like they wanted to save money on hiring new actors and using new sets. We can use that. We spent a lot of money on this sky hotel room set. You know, we don't have money to put a set for the Tet. Let's just have it all blow up. And you know what? I got a great idea. What if they were clones? That'll solve everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, they're clones with jurisdiction, right? Because there's the repairman over the hill, and he takes care of all that. And
And
none of these guys ever, you know, decided to get together and have a, well, let's have a, end of Earth repairman party.
Or like a softball game.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. Let's get together and have a, yeah, it's like the janitor's union or something. They should get together and like.
Yeah, that's again, they're falling into a sci-fi trope where when you have clones, if they don't know about each other, that's pretty typical. If they do know about each other, one's typically evil. You know, he has the goatee. Or one gives of himself, like gives his life, which is what happens here. And
or you get the funny one, like in Multiplicity,
right?
Number four, that guy
right.
is hysterical.
They start, right, is a copy of a copy of a copy. It starts having problems.
She touched my peppy, Steve.
Or they could have gotten twins with it. Danny DeVito could have been the
sure,
clone.
Sure. The clone with everything, the clone with everything.
But the thing is, like,
here's the thing. We start giggling when we hear clones. We really do.
Right, and the property that I feel, as a science fiction fan, that dealt with it best is the sci-fi show Farscape. Because they knew, walking into it, that they're going to have to deal with the clone, you know, the cliche of the clone. And what they did instead was they changed the language of what was happening. They didn't say it was cloning, it was twinning. There's no original or there's no copies. They're both equal.
Okay.
And then they did away with that language for the rest of this one season, and it incensed, it incensed fans, because they started reverting to the language of the clone. And so they knew that they were going to walk into that, and they decided to play around with it.
Look, this is the clone is as a literary mechanism as old as like anything. Okay, Shakespeare used to use mistaken identity all the time. Twins, you know, it's great for reveals, except when it's your third act reveal.
Right.
When your whole third act reveal is based on it, then it just feels cheap.
They should. I don't mind that they had it, but I agree. It's like one of the things that I think happens in a lot of films is they need to pull it up a little more explicitly earlier, because in this, one of the things I actually liked was the thematic element. It takes place on page 22, is in Jack is talking about going out and exploring things, and he says, you know, it just showed like her, he's saying this thing is precious, it's from where we are from, we should take care of it, and she's like, whatever. It's, you know, and it's like life.
I like when he goes down and he found that little
the little island.
Utopia. It reminded me of the Genesis Cave from Wrath of Khan. It was awesome. I was like
thinking about
more of that.
I was thinking Jeremiah Johnson.
Okay, cool. Yeah.
But so she has like a disregard for things that are precious, things that are life, because she doesn't keep any of the, she, you know, obviously she doesn't have a chance, but she doesn't find value in the things that he finds. And I knew right away their relationship was doomed when that happened.
Yeah.
You know, you're not supporting your man's, you know, your hobby. But anyway, you're not supporting your man's hobbies. I liked it that it wasn't, you know, like a typical, you know, action movie. Because a lot of science fiction movies are just action movies in space with laser guns. And so it was nice to see that they were kind of, you know.
What do you have against laser guns?
I don't have anything about it against laser guns.
Laser sharks. Laser. I wanted as much lasers.
Laser on its head. We already have dolphins that do that for real. So
yeah, drones are so yesterday. That's
yeah,
like laser dolphins.
We want laser dolphins. But I did like that. And it seems, despite how we may feel about the third act reveal and the ending, I do think they were trying to say a little something more than, you know, a typical, you know, shoot 'em up.
A little environmental message, yeah.
Maybe not just that, but it's because it doesn't just say, like, you know, we need to keep the earth green and whole. I mean, there is a whole scene where the drones destroy the artwork and the keepsakes in the I guess, the scavs, hidey hole.
Right.
You know, so it's not just about the environment. It's like, look at what we have. Let's take care of it. And it doesn't just mean let's keep the world green. The action sequences were great, like the one I read at the beginning. The potential visuals. And I say potential because obviously he doesn't go too deep into it. But
but if you've seen the trailer, it looks like they've capitalized on these, you know.
And what I liked about
that's good meat for a sci-fi movie. Beautiful visuals of a desolate, like,
well, that's
like
the thing. So
apocalyptic earth.
That's what most people are talking about when they talk about this movie. Aren't the action sequences? They're talking about the visual language of it. The sky above, a beautiful desolate planet. Mysterious black sand dunes, active volcanoes, swirling orange and gold sediment, steaming bright blue hot springs and rich brown craters. And that's on page 5. It's 4 lines. It's, what, 2 sentences?
Yeah, director Joseph Kosinski, I mean, one of the things that was amazing about Tron Legacy was the aesthetic. It was gorgeous.
Right.
It was fantastic.
And so that's what, you know, and to speak to that in the script, in this script, is like, the thing that most people talk about is 4 lines in the script. And they go back to it again and again, and it becomes, I think, more and more shorthand. But, you know, it's like one line describes probably the best thing about what wound up on screen. And another thing I liked about the script was less is more. Now, the issue I had was that less was more, because I wanted to see the Tet inhabitants. Do they eat, you know, cucumber sandwiches? Do they have orgies? I mean, this is PG-13, so that would be hinted. But
I think we got our own movie there.
Yeah, probably. But it's like one of those things. I wanted to see more of things, and that speaks to, like, a great setup by the writers, Monahan, and I don't want to butcher the man's last name, Carl. I wanted more time on the Tet, because we just see like a storage area or hangar area.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, I want to see more than that. I know that what
I want to see if the elite class up there have evil motivations or not.
Are they aliens or not, you know?
Are they aliens? Is there anybody there? Is it just these 6 clones?
Right.
Right?
So,
is there anything? Because I want to know, because we never actually know about the blown up moon, do we?
Right, no, we don't.
Do we find out how that happened?
Well, I think it was what he was saying in the action lines that was their greeting to us. It's like, hey, we, you know, we're saying we come in peace, we want to shake hands, and they go, screw you, let's blow up the moon.
How can you not open with that? That's the problem. If I'm doing a sci-fi movie that's about, and this was what set me off when I started reading this from the very first place, we get a voiceover, and this is something in NYC Screenwriters Collective we would have jumped on immediately.
Yeah.
And said, you just did, you know, did like a tell without showing. You just told the whole apocalypse without showing it. You're doing a sci-fi movie. We're not going to see the aliens attack, blow up the moon, and have Earth like everyone
eviscerated,
like, die, and then have to escape the planet. You're gonna do that in a voiceover. Turns out they had to because it didn't happen. Okay, and this is a little screenwriting problem I had with. You have Jack giving us the voiceover introduction, which is an unreliable narrator. I love an unreliable narrator. But you know what? You gave it to Jack. It should have been Victoria, okay, giving us the unreliable narrator. Or it should have been, like, the computer. Because what we find out later, you want the unreliable narrator, if you're lying to the audience, for us to find out that person's a bad guy in the story. And once that we find out that person's a bad guy in the story, then when we find out that they were unreliable, it harbors back. Having Jack give us the unreliable story of the apocalypse, it just makes him look like a dupe.
Well, and to capitalize on that, not only did they have the voiceover at the beginning, he retells the story at the midpoint to Julia.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I agree, it probably should have gone to somebody else. But it's like we don't need it because I think as an audience, we were kind of smart enough to kind of pick things up along the way. You know, if you see the debris of the moon in the sky, you kind of put two and two together.
It's pretty cool. I could watch that all day. I want to see the moon blown up every 10 different ways.
And it's
you know, I want to question you that. Planet of the Apes.
Mm-hmm.
We don't see the world end. We just get a reveal that
the it's world then. Right? Yeah, see, I'm actually kind of with you.
Yes,
I'm okay
yes.
With that.
But it's a different genre. It's a different genre. It's like
it's the same genre. It's just 50 years different. You know.
Okay, so they went with the reveal, but the reveal there was great. Okay, the reveal was we thought this was another planet we were on. Okay.
Well,
thought it was a whole planet, and they revealed to say, no, you're on the same planet. Well, it's just time travel.
Is the reveal at the end of Oblivion though? He flies into space and sees the moon?
What happened?
Like, does at the end of Oblivion, because maybe I missed this because I was just reading, you know, when I was reading it, does he fly into space to go to the Tet and look to his left or his right and go, oh, there's the moon whole? Did it not blow up at all? So it's like, if the moon actually did blow up, I'm okay with not seeing it because I think a better visual is a ring of debris around the planet because that speaks to us. But the thing is, like, it's like the Blade Runner voiceover in Blade Runner, version 1.0. where they have the voiceover because they didn't believe the audience could follow it.
Yeah.
And you know, you have Harrison Ford going, you know, blah, blah, you know, in a dead voice. And I felt like this, in this script, it was laid out well enough that we knew what was going to happen, or we knew what had happened. And it was, you know, especially at the midpoint, we're told, basically, Jack says, hey, this is what happened.
Yeah.
I mean, I think in cases like that, it's not what... The fact that the moon blew up isn't really what's interesting.
Right.
Or at least...
It looks nice, but it's not what's...
Right.
That story. But you know, so that was, you know, fair enough with that. I wanted more proof of humans on Earth, because I get the feeling I had in the script is like, that's it. Like, Beach and his group, now they're gone. And it's just, you know, Julia and Jack point... You know, Jack 2 and their kid.
Yeah.
Like, hey, you know, I didn't need to necessarily see those other groups of humans, but it's like, you know, hey, we have people in Moscow, we have people in Topeka, you know, Djibouti or wherever. And that made this epic world seem smaller. And part of that is because, you know, you have, like, you can count on your hand, you know, you have Jack, Victoria, Julia, Beach.
Yeah, but what that would give us is hope that you could actually resettle the planet, which is what we want in the end. That's what you want. The whole message here is, oh, we got to see if we can resettle the planet, not give up on it. In the beginning, we have those harvesters, like, stealing the water off the planet.
And the thing is, the last thing we see is Julia, the kid, and Jack 2, and that's it.
Yeah.
And so it's like, I don't mind seeing necessarily Jack 2 arrive. It's just that Julia should have been with another group of people. You know, she should have been with another, you know, I want to say colony, but it's probably not the right word. But another, you know, another group like Beach had, where we know that it's not.
And I like how Julia 1 ends up with Jack 2, and she's like, eh, this is just as good.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm okay with
this. We probably get along.
The final thing that two final things that I want to say is, like, I felt like they needed a better antagonist than Drone 166.
Oh, please.
You know, I don't necessarily need a Darth Vader, but I want something more than a drone, because it is literally faceless. I know they're probably...
Who's running the drones?
Right, and so that's why I wanted
Who's
to see...
Who's the elite class up on the Tet?
And more than just lines on a computer screen, which I like the lines on the computer screen,
but
I want to hear a voice.
It may very well have been Vader.
Like, yeah, see, that's my point.
<It's> like, but we don't know.
It's like a side job. It's like, oh, we have this Earth planet in a galaxy far away, and I'm just, you know, we're just harvesting.
They were practicing the Death Star on the moon.
Yeah, you know. Yeah. But, and the final thing is, like, I didn't want a timeline, because they said, they implied that the last Super Bowl is 2 years from now, 2015, and that the Giants won.
Interesting.
And that it's 2017.
So New York oriented. He's wearing a Yankees cap.
Yeah, you know.
The whole place, all the stuff they show is New York.
Right, and
in the trailer anyway.
And that, again, I think lends to the small scale feel of it, even though it's this grand film. But the thing I don't like is like 20. I don't mind that, you know, I want it to be set in the future, obviously. I don't want a timeline. And this is just a thing.
Because what does it do?
Well, it's like we're coming up on 2019, which is when Blade Runner is set. Where's my replicant? Okay? Where's my replicant? One of my favorite Japanese stories, Ghost in the Shell, is set in 2035.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can't jump online without a computer right now like they can in Ghost in the Shell. You're giving me a timeline.
Right, it's like, where's my hoverboard?
Right, where's my hoverboard? Okay, you know, yeah. Which is in 2 years. I get a hoverboard in 2 years.
Jeez.
And Jaws 19, I think, is in 2 years as well.
Can't wait.
We're only up to four.
Yeah.
So, it's just a pet peeve of mine. All right,
so let's sum it up. Last comments on Oblivion.
I definitely want to see this.
Yeah, I'll go see it.
Yeah, I mean, despite the complaints, I really like the screenplay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
And I heard the movie has maybe a different ending, so.
Yeah, the movie I heard has a different ending, so. Great screenplay. We'll see about the movie.
Cuba Gooding shows up, and he's like, show me the money.
Anthony Edwards is a.
Right, Anthony Avery shows up, comes back from the dead. He's on the tet. He's angry at Maverick. It's a whole thing.
It's a whole thing
where Goose is trying to get back at Maverick. All right.
That would be pretty awesome.
Fantastic. All right. Chris, thank you. Chris, thank you. And that's that.
Your mom's a four quadrant.
Your mom's a four quadrant.
This is Mike DeLuca, your tracking board czar, with a monthly update on the treasures you can find at the tracking board, a website that specializes in the entertainment news, stuff burning a trail throughout the town. Spec scripts out, spec scripts sold, casting attachments. Basically, six flavors of awesome. Today, I'll just give you a mere sample. Specs out, from Jose Prendes, we have Taurus Trap, our newest Die Hard riff, now that such a spec is back in style. Logline, pitched in the vein of Die Hard, a New York City cop on vacation in sunny Los Angeles unwittingly stops a terrorist attack on Hollywood Boulevard and pits himself against a gang of badasses searching for a dirty bomb in a mile-long traffic accident on the 101. New York City cop fighting terrorists in Los Angeles? That's not a riff on Die Hard. That is Die Hard. I mean, are we going to get a dirty undershirt as well? I saw those posters for White House Down. Channing Tatum, you're not fooling anyone. You're not fooling me. It comes as no surprise that Prendes cut his teeth at the film studio known as The Asylum. I'm sure you remember back in the day when there was actually a thing called Blockbuster Video, and then on the shelves there were movies that looked like popular movies but weren't in fact popular movies. Those films. In 2013, he wrote Hansel and Gretel, an attempt to capitalize on that Jeremy Renner thing we can somewhat refer to as a film. And the inelegantly titled Terminator Salvation rip, The Terminators. Well, I guess ripping off John McClane says he's got good taste. But at the same time, come on, man. Exhibit B. Also in the market, Encounters, from writers David Fregario and James Edwin Myers. Pitched in the vein of Close Encounters meets Eagle Eye. A father and daughter begin having strange encounters with extraterrestrials. Christopher Walken doesn't count. I can see it now. Shia LaBeouf can play the Francois Truffaut role. Casting solved? Fregario sold his Afghanistan war spec to Armory Films, Bender Spinkweiner, last August. The writers are managed by the Hung Entertainment Group. Exhibit C, having received some heat for their reality show meets Ghostbusters spec, Spirit Stalkers. Veteran actors turned writing team Richard Eaton and Shannon Heil have out the inn, a romantic supernatural spec, pitched as The Notebook meets Ghost. Young widow returns to the seaside inn where she spent her childhood and falls for a mysterious man with a dark secret. So let me guess, he's dead, she's horny, they both love pottery, and then they get old. Seriously, though, the writers are managed by Kaylee Marsh of Station 3, and one can easily see the spec appealing to the Twilight demographic. God help us all. Also out, from writer Ben Maggott, most widely known for selling his Seven Likes Peter Pan specs script, titled Pan, to New Line back in 2006, is out with a new spec called Pulse, which is pitched in the vein of Contact and Event Horizon. Hopefully it'll be less like Contact, because I don't want to see David Morse at the other end of the universe. Oops, spoiler. And more like Event Horizon, because the world needs more insane Sam Neill. Specs sold. We've got a ton of contained thrillers. We've got Just Nadler, veteran of the 2010 tracking board hit list, just burning a hole in Relativity Media's pocket with House Arrest, in which two high-end Bond traders decide to end their marriage just before they are forced to live together for 6 months of house arrest. Yes, it does seem a lot like 1996's House Arrest. You know, with Kevin Pollak and Jamie Lee Curtis, they get held hostage by their kids so they won't get divorced. That classic. But it comes as no surprising that such a trope that, frankly, harks back to old sitcoms like Three's Company, that Adler actually has a background in television, executive producing on Better Off Dead and on Brothers and Sisters. But he mostly is known for bursting on the spec scene in 2010 with the sale of The Escort to DreamWorks, a kind of riff on John Hughes' Dutch. He's represented by UTA. But see, Peter A. Dowling, the guy who wrote Flight Plan, he's back with another spec, contained, called High Rise, which is a dusting off of 1965's William Wyler directed film, Terrence Stamp, starring The Collector. It's a psycho thriller. Creepy as hell. And another contained. Let's see, we've got Matthew Cruise, his script guest. Yes, another Cinderella story from Script Shadow, the controversial Carson Reeves blog. It's pitched in the vein of Rear Window because it's the script Alfred Hitchcock only wished he could write. If filmed properly, Polanski's Repulsion. If filmed not, Scissors with Sharon Stone. In any case, we've got specs that are all contained. So if you've got that spec script about the mother-in-law trapped in the garbage truck and needs to get out within 48 hours, this is your time, to quote Mikey from Goonies. This is your tracking board czar, Mike DeLuca, signing off, saying, I'll see you at Swizz and buy me a barrel. Beer, wine, give me cash. I'll take it all.
Welcome to another micro-installment of The Baron's Corner, broadcasting from 238th Street and Hunts Point Avenue, the very heart of New York City. Foul is fair and fair is foul. And there's an ice cream truck parked and idling outside my window. This month I want to talk about a new film made 4 years ago. Lifelines, starring Jane Addams and Josh Pice. Written, directed, produced, and sitting Shiva, David Margolis. Lifelines chronicles the hapless Bernstein family, Ira, Nancy, Michael, Megan, and Spencer, as they try to catch up to the life they are living. That last sentence is from the logline of the film and may well explain the less than successful elements in the script. Is it a family drama? Is it a black comedy? A psychological thriller? An indefinable indie glob of spit in the face of arch structure? Can Bizet's Habanera be used ever again in a film after the Bad News Bears? Films that take place in a psychiatrist's office are legion, but it is generally broken up with visits outside the office, unlike Lifelines, which spends a third of the film in a long, unbroken segment in the middle of the film, listening to a magical psychiatrist unlock and solve each family member's most hidden secrets. Part Sherlock Holmes, part gifted therapist, he can even guess what number you're thinking if it's between 1 and 10. And in one session. New Yorkers who spend a large part of the money they should be saving on therapy must have found this amusing in its 9 days at the Quad Cinema in Greenwich Village. I would entreat all those who aspire to writing a successful feature script to take a close look at this film, both what to do and what not to do. The script has some fine writing in it. Josh Pice telling his kids how they were born and how much they mean to him. Jane Addams telling Josh that her kids are making her life a hell. Full disclosure, the Baron may have been distracted by Jane Addams' performance. Every role she takes from Happiness to Hung has a luminous sensuality and intelligence that clouds my vision. If only she were given more to do in this script. True story. I sat next to her at an Italian restaurant in Carroll Gardens a few years ago. She left her sweater on the chair as she left. I attempted to bring it to her, but a cloying, swarthy waiter snatched it from me and thus ruined my only chance at true love. Damn you, Camerieri. I said it was a new four-year-old film. It was released in 2009 and soon thereafter fell into a deep, dark oblivion. A place where no light and sound can escape. The Vault of Orcus. Sort of like Michael Richards' comedy career. But it was resurrected, as many new independent films are, by the Netflix, Amazon, Vudu time space machine. In the case of Lifelines, it appeared in February on Vudu. In the old days of straight-to-video, the film would be available a year or so after release and then go to a reformatted VHS tape on your local video shelf. I watched Lifelines in a format unheard of in the 90s, HDX. Thus, quirky independence can get another day in the sun. A second life in high definition, if you will. Well, you've been a charming audience, but the producer is holding a stiletto to my chest, and it looks like she means business this time. Look for the small films, my friends, and we'll meet next time in the Baron's Corner.
The Script is the official podcast of the NYC Screenwriters Collective. It is produced and edited by Tawny Foskett. Chris Durham is our sound recordist and mixer. If you live in NYC, check out our weekly review meetings through meetup.com at NYC Screenwriters Collective. Find us on Facebook at NYC Screenwriters Collective. Follow us on Twitter at ScriptFeed and email us at ScriptFeed@gmail.com.